Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
And just a few days ago, the October 26th movement in Saudi Arabia that's received 17,000 signatures on their petition for women to be able to drive staged a lot of protests around the country via YouTube. And I guess for Americans, it's pretty extraordinary to figure out why it is that women can't drive in Saudi Arabia. I mean, what the clerics argue there is pretty surreal, that the hardline clerics say allowing women to drive will lead to licentiousness. And a prominent cleric said on national Saudi TV that medical studies show that driving a car harms a woman's ovaries. So is this a part of a larger battle going on between reformers and hardline clerics?
Yes, it is. I mean, Saudi Arabia is the only country on this planet where women are not allowed to drive. And it is not just the clerics that are against women driving. It's actually most people are under the impression that it is the religious fanatics and the clerics that are opposed to women driving, when in fact it is the whole system. The royal family doesn't want this to happen for economic and political reasons. Economically speaking, if half of society is unaccounted for, which is woman in this case, then that exonerates the system from taking care and meeting its obligation towards all of its citizens, so men and women. In this case, they only deal with half of society, which is men. So that is the economic reason, that to relieve the government from creating jobs and hospitals and working unions and that kind of thing. That's the economic part of it. Politically, it is the Machiavellian theory. It is divide and conquer. And the Saudi regime have succeeded in dividing society into halves, men and women. And the men and women now are blaming each other for all kinds of social illnesses and problems, including the fact that if Saudi women are allowed to drive, they will lose their virginity. And that is not acceptable in a Muslim state. So the religious establishment and the religious clerics are only the long arm of the royal family. They do the dirty job, the job for the royal family, and that's their assignment, and the religious establishment knows that, and they have accepted that assignment. So it's divide and conquer. It is not meeting all citizens' needs, and it's much deeper than just religion, because religion has nothing. There is nothing in the Quran or there is nothing in Islamic tradition that says women cannot drive, because when the Quran was written in the 7th century, there were no cars and no airplanes and no medications and nothing. I mean, the main food for the desert dwellers at the time when the Quran was written was the main sustenance is locusts, and the main transportation were camels. Otherwise, it would have been written in the Quran, but it is more political and it is more economic than it is anything else.
So in terms of the Al Saud family, the family that controls Saudi Arabia, and with its thousands of princes all the way up to the king, Abdullah, I take it that they've invented the religious police, Mutahween.
Yes, they appoint them. The
right.
King appoints all the religious clerics, including the Mufti, who is the peace moth for the royal family.
Right.
They appointed them. They paid their salaries. It's a government agency.
Right. But isn't there a political purpose here? If you have such a repressive society where you have religious police out making sure women don't drive, making sure that nothing shows underneath the burqas, etc., and all of these strictures. And I remember when a girls' school caught on fire, the fire brigade ready to rescue these girls, but the religious police forbade them from rescuing the girls because they were wearing indoor clothing and not outdoor clothing, and the women, the young girls, all burned to death as a result of this insanity. But is this a form of political oppression? In other words, if you control people via religion, which is so pervasive, then they don't have any opportunity to even think about political revolution.
No, political revolution is going to come to Saudi Arabia for the same reason you mentioned. The oppression is severe, and the women's school that were in fire in 2002 were in Mecca, actually, the Holy Land. And when the fire broke out, the young girls, school girls, tried to escape, and the religious establishment locked them in, and they were incinerated in the fire, which is unbelievable action by somebody who called themselves religious people. These people are anything but religious. They are extremist, terrorist, legal terrorist organization whose job and assignment is to actually terrorize the Saudi people and force them into total submission, not to God, but to the royal family and to the clerics themselves. It is a political oppression. It is the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia. It's only a tool. It is a tool of the system to maintain total control over every aspect of people's life, men and women. But that is changing. Women themselves, just like you mentioned earlier, are actually in the forefront of calling for changing society, and they are doing it slowly. They need our support, you and me and every decent human being, because actually empowering Saudi women is in the best interest of the United States and of all democracies, because Saudi woman gains can only happen at the expense of the religious establishment. So they deserve our support because they're changing the country and they are doing the job we are now supposed to be fighting, and that's religious extremism and its byproduct, terrorism.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. So this protest that took place, a national protest in Saudi Arabia where women were driving and a lot of their home videos were posted on YouTube, this took place on October the 26th. The last time there was a nationwide protest was in 1990 when 50 women were arrested. They had their passports confiscated and they lost their jobs. I take it this time around they weren't cracked down on in quite such a tough manner. So is there anybody within the royal family that maybe is more sympathetic to the women? Or is there any fissures in the Al Saud's? As you point out, it's all a kind of feint that they really are behind the religious police. They control them as a tool of oppression. But is there any enlightenment in the Al Saud family?
Well, there is not, because they are any nicer today than they were yesterday. They are reading the writing in the wall, which is due to the Arab Spring, but also the Saudi people, men and women, especially women, they have become more educated, and thanks to the social media, the invention of the infidels, the social media is changing the surface of the world, and Saudi Arabia is among the beneficiaries. The people of Saudi Arabia are among the most beneficiaries of the social media. So the people now are not afraid to speak their minds. They are now discussing the illegitimacy of the Saudi government. They are challenging the religious establishment, and they are discovering, thanks to those of us who are trying to explain to people, that religion has become a tool of oppression, exploitation, corruption, repression of society. So the people now are talking without fear like they used to in the past, and they can't talk without getting caught because social media is helping them in that direction. So there are some princes and princesses, actually, who are, these are people like you and me. They are human beings, too. But they become more educated, and they were educated in Western universities, and they enjoyed the liberties they get, they don't get in Saudi Arabia, and they become more aware of the system's repressive practices and policies. So there are some princes and princesses who are speaking more about modernity, about some elections, about some constitutions, about, yeah, none of the Saudi princes who are speaking in these terms think that anybody should rule the country or could rule the country except themselves. But they are realizing more and more that their survival depend upon some sharing of power and some political inclusions and some of the rights that women are calling for. So the country, there is some changes, not because the system is any better today than it was yesterday. It just doesn't have too many options but to bend back and think a little bit that its survival depend upon some compromising with the society.
So when King Abdullah has introduced changes such as allowing women to sit on the National Advisory Council and permitting them to vote and run in municipal elections, that's just sort of window dressing or pragmatism, but there's no intention. I mean, all you have to do is look at the Saudi Arabian policy towards Egypt, where they're behind, in many ways, behind the military coup. The king was furious that with Obama. He called him all the time during the protests in Tahrir Square against Mubarak, basically saying to Obama, let Mubarak shoot those kids. And now they've been able, through Saudi money, bring about a counter-revolution in Egypt. And it's very paradoxical that the Saudi Arabians and the Israelis are both on the same page in terms of their policy towards Egypt. But in terms of what's going on in the civil war in Syria, what we're continually hearing is that the funding for the extremist Wahhabi Salafist groups like al-Nusra is not coming from the Saudi government, but coming from wealthy individuals in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, etc. So I don't understand how you can have a complete police state as you have in Saudi Arabia, where the royal family controls everything, including the bodies of all of their people, and particularly the women, with absolute control, and yet they can't control wealthy Saudis sending money to al-Nusra?
That's a very good point. You are absolutely right. I mean, they control every aspect of people's lives and livelihood, and the banks and the airplanes and the information, you know, agencies. And no, it's not just the Saudi wealthy people. And the Saudi wealthy people, or the wealthy Saudis, would never dare to send any money to anybody if they don't believe that's what the government wants them to do. So that is absolutely an unwinning argument. But it is not just the wealthy Saudis and the clerics and other people. The Saudi government itself and the Qatari government, but now it's mostly the Saudi government, is arming and paying for the jihadis, al-Qaeda, and al-Nusra, and other people. These are documented facts. The Saudis themselves admitted it. Prince Bandar, former Saudi ambassador to the United States, and now he's the head of the Saudi intelligence agency. The United States, the reason the United States have not invaded Syria, because the alternative will be a Saudi jihadi state. That's a fact of life, too. So, but in terms of our relation, the Saudi-America relationship is entering into a very, very dead end, because two things that the Saudi government wants the United States to do is to invade Syria, topple Assad, and give Syria to the Nusra and al-Qaeda and others who will be under the Saudi control. Bandar said this much, actually, when he visited Russia and talked to Putin, the president of Russia, to let go of Assad, and the Saudis will make sure any government that take place after he is gone will be under Saudi control, and they will work with Russia, and even volunteered. These are documented. Bandar volunteered that the Olympic Games, which will be held in Russia, will be secured because the Saudis control the Chechenian terrorist organizations. All of these are documented. I'm not telling you anything that you cannot Google and find out. So, no, the Saudi regime is the one who is financing the al-Nusra and extremist groups in Syria, not just the wealthy Saudis.
So at this point, there's a growing tension in the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and also the U.S. and Israel over the tentative outreach to Iran and the P5 plus one talks that are going on and the extent to which the U.S. is following the decision not to intervene in Syria has started to communicate with Iran, and this has upset both the Saudis and the Israelis. Is there anything that the Saudi Arabians can do in terms of changing their foreign policy that would be detrimental to the United States? The overall point is that the entire relationship is a sick one, where the Saudis are actually, they created the Taliban, they created al-Qaeda, they created al-Nusra, they've destabilized Pakistan, they've destabilized Nigeria through the Boko Haram, Somalia. I mean, the list goes on. So it's an illusion to think that we have anything but a sick relationship with Saudi Arabia. But within that context, my understanding is that the Saudis are threatening to form other alliances. Is that what you understand?
Yeah, but where can they go? They tried, actually. They have tried Russia. They have tried even the Arab League that the Saudis paid billions of dollars to purchase, like Egypt. Even the Arab League did not support the Saudi campaign to invade Syria militarily by anybody. They have failed. They have failed in veering Hamas away from Iran. They have failed in recruiting the Russians to support them and Europeans. And now they are miserably failing with this administration. So they have failed in everywhere. And now they are realizing actually that they have known this for 100 years. They are realizing that the United States is the only one that had the power to, for example, defend the Saudis and others and make sure the oil flow from the Persian Gulf continue. But one of their biggest nightmares, the Saudis, if not the biggest nightmare at this point, is to have some kind of reconciliation between the United States and the West in general and Israel with the Iranians, because they feel, and rightfully so, if there is reconciliation between the United States and the West and Iran, the Saudis will be marginalized because Iran is the only Muslim country across the Gulf from them that actually compete with the Saudi regime over strategic, economic, and religious leadership in Arab and Muslim countries. So they are scared to death from that. In terms of the Saudis punishing the United States, there is absolutely nothing they could do. Their influence, even in their neighborhood, is dwindling. Their influence globally is dwindling. Their influence in OPEC is dwindling. There is more now oil and energy sources, including within this country, but also all over the world. And once Iraq is stabilized, it has more reserve than Saudi Arabia, and that oil come online, the Saudis will be nothing. They are scared and they have nowhere to go, and there is nothing they can do to the United States at all. And the Saudis know it too.
Well, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he has lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.